This is Digital Story Podcast number 1000, May 20th, 2025. Today's theme is a 20-year celebration. I'm Derek Story. The TDS podcast debuted on October 5th, 2005. It was my side hustle. During the weekdays, I was an online editor for O'Reilly Media. As part of my job, I met interesting people and traveled to fascinating locations. I wanted to share those experiences and build a community of photographers. So at night, I worked on my website and recorded those early shows. Fast forward 20 years later to this episode, number 1000. With a little help from my friends, it's time to tell the story of how we all ended up here together. I hope you enjoy the show. What I have for you today are interviews with some of the people that were very important to me along the way, thoughts from Inner Circle members that are willing to share what this community means to them, some snippets from shows going way back in the time machine, and a little bit of me along the way. Now, I'm going to stay out of the way as much as possible and let these folks tell the story of the digital story over the last 2 decades. If you refer to the show notes, you will see everyone's name who participates in the order that they appear in the show. We're not going to do any camera industry news. We're not going to do any virtual camera club news. I am going to give a big thank you right now to Red River Paper, who have been with us practically the entire journey. Thank you so much, Red River Paper, for your sponsorship and support of this community. We had such a good turnout in terms of contributing to the show that I wasn't able to get everyone on this particular podcast. But those folks will appear in upcoming episodes. So if that happens to be you, fear not, you will still get to tell your story. But really what I think we should do right now is let's go back to October 2005, where it all began.
Welcome to the Digital Story Show, new tools for the creative mind. The Digital Story Show takes you inside with tips for the creative pursuit of photography, music, video, hardware, software, techniques, and hacks. You'll soon find yourself thinking less about buttons and menus and more about expressing the artist inside us all. Now the Digital Story Show with Derek Story.
The Digital Story Audio Show, October 5th, 2005, with your host Derek Story. New tools for the creative mind. We're going to talk about everything here that relates to photography, audio, video, you name it, we're going to be covering it. Today, though, I want to jump right into some photography techniques that I think everyone can use to improve their... That voice you heard on the introduction is from Scott Shepard. Scott Shepard was so important in helping me launch this show. For years, he had his own show called Inside Mac Radio, and he had notables such as Ken Ray on his show who did the news. And now Ken Ray does Mac OS Ken and is still doing those podcasts to this day. In fact, it's one of the shows that I listen to. And when I wanted to get started in podcasting, I didn't know how to do any of this. I really didn't. And Scott said, I can help you with the recording and the editing and the production of the show if you can find folks to help you on the back end. And I am forever grateful to Scott. He helped me through many episodes. Eventually, I learned how to do all of those pieces myself. But if it wasn't for Scott, I don't think I could have launched the show in 2005. Now, I did a podcast dedicated to Scott Shepard, because he passed away in 2016. I lost a friend. I lost someone who was important to my career and someone who was truly one of the nicest people I had ever met. So in the show notes, I have a link to that podcast, number 548, from September 6, 2016, if you want to learn more about Scott. So now I think I'm going to let other people tell the story of the last 20 years. I have interviews and comments and snippets for you, and I'm just going to let them run. Now, I'll come back on near the end of the show for a few final words, but right now, I'm going to turn it over to Frederick Van and myself. We did an interview, and then we're just going to roll on from there. Frederick, great to see you again. It's been a while, right?
Yeah, man. It's good to see you, too. Yeah, it's been years since we've shaken hands.
It has been. Of course, you know, all this virtual stuff, you know, it makes it easy for us not to actually get together in the same bar, or I mean, same room and, and catch up on what's going on.
Freudian slip.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you know, absolutely.
We'll talk about TWIP, of course, because, you know, TWIP is where a lot of my audience found out about me being on your shows, which was a great time for me. But we go back beyond that. And I want to go all the way back to when you were working at Apple and I was, working with O'Reilly and we were talking about working together on like Inside Lightroom and that kind of stuff. You mind talking about that?
Yeah, man. Oh, you're bringing me way, way back in time. I feel like that was on a parallel Earth or something. But yeah, I was when I joined Apple, don't ask me the year, it was a long time ago. I joined Apple as the product marketing manager for iDVD. You remember that piece of software?
I do.
So, which was part of the iLife suite, which included iDVD, iPhoto, iMovie, and iTunes. So all those were literally in a box at one point. And I got to hang out inside the belly of the beast there and see how the sausage is made, learn the secrets, you know, not tell the secrets to stay, you know, all that. Yeah. So I got a chance to meet you and a couple of other amazing authors while I was there. Cause I was, you know, you get the little jobs in the departments like, okay, you are in charge of this and you are in charge of that, in addition to the other stuff. And one of my things was being in some ways the liaison to a lot of our publishers that would get pre-briefed on software before it was released so you could start your books, you know, or yes. Briefing people in a press release, you know, after it's been released, all that stuff I got to handle. Not a low stress gig, I'll tell you that.
No, I can imagine.
One thing leak, yeah, it's over.
How did you get involved with the Lightroom project?
I was lucky enough to do my Jedi mind trick on the Adobe folks and join the Lightroom team as a product manager over there.
Which is when we crossed again. So then yeah. I had already been working on some stuff with Apple on Aperture and the Adobe folks go, you know, we'd kind of like some space in the O'Reilly world for Lightroom. We're working together again. And then it didn't seem too long after that, but it probably was longer than I recall. Because like you said, everything gets kind of squished. Then suddenly you were working, you had TWIP.
It kind of seemed like another
sort of like, wait, he's got TWIP now? I mean, I thought that was Scott and those other guys, you know.
I'll tell you how that went down. So yeah, I was at Adobe and I was the guest. That would come on the show as like the corporate Adobe guy with the, you know, the cagey Adobe guy that can't tell you the secrets, but he knows everything, you know, but he'll explain this latest release and all and why it's important. And then, you know, so I kind of started doing that. And then, you know, you're talking about Alex Lindsay, Scott Bourne.
Yes.
Yeah. Leah Laporte. It was that crew. And it was Alex Lindsay, Scott Bourne, and me. Right. And this was pre-Zoom, pre-Skype, all that. I literally had to drive from Cupertino all the way up to San Francisco, park in the parking garage, walk with my book bag to the studio that they had set up, sit down with your coffee, get behind the mic and do the show, right? And then maybe go grab dinner afterwards and drive home. That was how we did TWIP. And now I just roll into this room and log into Zoom and we're doing TWIP, right? So they started it way, way back in the day and then decided basically through a series of events, decided they did not want to do it anymore and we're gonna sunset TWIP. So I was ironically around the time when that was going down, Adobe laid off about 800 people in one day. You probably remember that bloodbath, right? So it was like Saving Private Ryan in the parking garage. I had triage set up. Go to this station and get your Cobra. Go to that station and get your this. Go over there and hand over your laptop. It was horrible. So I'm home licking my wounds, and I needed something to. I didn't know that I was ready to go find another job. Of course you need a job, but I was like, okay, I don't know exactly what I want to target. I still have PTSD from this one. What is next? So I decided to take that energy. And the other thing was I didn't want a blank in my resume either, right? Back then, I don't know if it's still true now. You don't want this, well, where were you? What were you doing during this window of time? So I wasn't going to say, oh, I was backpacking around Europe to find myself, right? I wanted to say, well, I was doing these things that relate to the job that I'm looking for, right? So I'm in marketing and all that stuff. So like, why don't I focus that energy and see if I can't take that fledgling kind of podcast that's now, orphaned, to a degree. Why don't I take that and see if I can't add the stuff that I know about marketing and all that into it? And I think Alex was still running it at the time. I forget how everything went down, but eventually I just started all the socials, the emails, built a website, started hosting the thing, infrastructure, just put it all together as a kind of like a marketing case study. Like, what would you do if you had this thing and you wanted it to be taken seriously as a media property? How would you get from not a media property, hobby-ish, to Nikon's calling, so that's kind of what I did. But the credit for the beginnings of it, and I forget how long they were doing TWIP before it kind of decided to not be TWIP anymore. But Alex and Scott Bourne were the forces behind it, and I to some degree I'd say Leo Laporte as well, because they were all they look like the cool kid clique over there, right? The This Week in Tech, Mac Break Weekly, all that, the cool kids running that stuff. So, and they still do much of that stuff is still running over there. But, and then comes Nerdy Frederick in with, hey, welcome to TWIP.
Well, on those, I remember on the early TWIP shows, Alex was still a part of it. So there must have been kind of a gradual transition there because, and he was nerding out as always, and we were talking more like applications and stuff, and he was like always digging around under the hood of stuff,
Yeah, because his background is like that high-end Lucasfilm level stuff, right? Like, so it was very much like doing something as pedestrian as TWIP for someone of the horsepower of an Alex Lindsay, is like, okay, do you really need a fighter jet to fly from San Francisco to LA? Now, he just all this horsepower, which meant people that could, that wanted that horsepower could find it. You could hear, wow, somebody in the industry that's straddling both worlds, sort of amateur, semi-professional photography, and then the whole production cinematography world, which of course is also photography. So, but he could talk that language of the people that live on set. Right, versus okay, what's an f-stop and how does it relate to shutter speed? You're right, he was well beyond that, which gave the show just an amazing amount of torque. Same with Scott Bourne, all those guys just they've forgotten more than most people know. So
So then the show kind of took on its own personality. So eventually Alex kind of rolled off, right? And was, it seems like he was doing a lot of big jobs, video
White
jobs and all that
House.
kind of stuff. And then you started bringing in, I was in on some of the early shows, but then there you had a group that kind of became regular guests. on Flip, and that was a really neat period, that period, mid early days, I'll call them.
And truth be told, I'm bringing those mid early days back,
Oh,
right?
wow.
So, yeah, because I think that was the one-on-one interviews and that kind of deep dive into one topic type podcast discussions. It's great, but it's only one flavor. I think another flavor is the panel, group that gets heated sometimes. They interrupt each other other times, but everybody is on the same page, generally speaking, and speaking and woven together with the common thread of photography, and you get those people on stage and give them a Google Doc with three or four topics that you're going to cover so they can get their mind straight about what you're going to talk about
Yep.
and just have a conversation, right? Just
And
like
it was
this.
super enjoyable too. I mean, I really did like it. And we had different viewpoints, but yet, we're all kind of photographers and video people and all that. And I just thought it had a nice breadth to it. It covered a nice wide swath. And they were enjoyable. They were enjoyable. I mean, I think the pace was good and all that as well. And
It was fun to do.
they were very fun to do. And as I mentioned at the top of this interview, a lot of people told me that they found out about Digital Story from my time that I spent on TWIP, because I was definitely on TWIP more than any other podcast, other than my own. The thing about then, and I think I want to talk about this just for a minute. The thing about then, I think, that was so incredible is that the signal to noise was so much better for us. And what I mean by, if you started a podcast and it was halfway decent, there weren't 5 million photography podcasts. There were what, maybe 100 or 200, something like that. And you had a chance. You had a chance to become a popular show. And I feel like now it's so much tougher for the people that want to break into the podcast. Now you're competing against celebrities and corporations and all that kind of stuff. But at the time, it was us. It was just us.
It was, and yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, it's definitely much more crowded than it was back then. But for people that are starting or have aspirations to start a podcast, and they're like, I'm gonna jump into that ocean with all the, I think yes, back then it was less crowded, but we were much more broad. I think with the mass of people in podcasting or whatever, live streaming, Twitch, etc., it brings the ability to find an audience at a much more niched down level, right? So instead of like This Week in Photo, right? Back then we started This Week in Photo was like, we are going to talk about whatever happened in the photography industry this past week. Maybe we'll just talk about composition, but that's the thrust of the show. Whereas today they could dive in and say, we talk about landscape photography that was shot using an iPhone 12. That's
Right,
it.
exactly, exactly.
Right. So you have that luxury. Plus the tools are so much more mature now. We had to literally build a Rube Goldberg mechanism every time we want to put on a show back then. And it still didn't work right. Even if you tested it right before you went on and started recording, something would break. And now we could do a whole show from an iPad if we wanted to, or
Exactly.
our phone. All the variables shift around. Things get easier, the number of people in the space, increases, but so does the depth that you can go now because there's so much, the audience is bigger. So now you can niche down and still get the same amount of people that we got back then, right?
Yeah.
So
I think that's interesting because, I just think about me, and maybe this is just my own wiring. It would be difficult for me to just work in a niche for a number of years. In other words, I could probably do it for a year or two, but the only way that I've survived, and I'd be curious to hear how you've survived as well. The only way I've survived is I just said, you know what, whatever interests me this week, that's what I'm doing the podcast on. So it is literally a podcast about my life as a photographer and, a Mac guy and all that kind of stuff. Because I came to the point where I couldn't do a show every week if I had to do it on something other than my life. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I
I'm
do. I do.
curious as to how have you kept going this long?
It's a lot of things, right? Part of it is being authentic, like you just touched on. You can't be a caricature of yourself for a sustained amount of time. And at a certain point, you're gonna be like, I just don't feel like being that guy anymore. I just want to be me, right? So if you're yourself, it's effortless. You just get in front of the camera and talking about stuff like and love and turn the camera off. So for me to keep going, I think one of the things that I enjoy doing is this, like having conversations and learning from people that know more than me about a certain topic or many topics, right? But having that conversation and putting myself in the position of my audience. So like I instead of me being like super interviewer, I'm gonna ask all these salient questions and I'm gonna make my guest uncomfortable and all that stuff. I generally pick topics to pick topics to talk about that I am interested in. Let's say generative AI, right? I'm interested in how that works and what's going on there and what the potential is for that. So if that's top of mind and I bring on somebody from one of these companies that's doing generative AI stuff, there are millions of people, or at least hundreds of thousands of people that are like me that are interested in that thing that have questions, right? So now I get to be the person to ask those questions. So I just become my audience and I ask those questions and it keeps me engaged. So I ask the logical next question usually because it's what they'd want to know. Like, hey, these AIs can do A, B, and C. Okay, but does that mean D, E, and F happens if you do A, B, and C? That's what people would want to know. So I ask those questions versus the, okay, so tell me about your next release or stuff that's like very television. My conversations are much more like you're chatting with somebody at a bar or a coffee shop or whatever, and you're interested in what that person has going on, and that's me. So by doing that, I can keep going because there's always something new
I mean, that's a
out there to
long
talk about.
runway. That's a long runway. And we both know in today's world of photography, imaging, technology, there is always something to talk about. There is always
Yeah.
something to talk about, you know.
Always.
Take care, man.
All right, Derek Story, take care.
My name is Jim Kuzman, and I live in Northeast Ohio, so a fair distance away from the Digital Story headquarters. And I started listening to the podcast in probably 2015 or 2016. And I was a regular listener, and I'd always was sort of intrigued by the idea of the in-person physical workshops, but I wasn't a traveler. Our family didn't travel for vacations. The Kuzmans were not a nomadic tribe, and I just never really thought, about traveling anywhere just for the purpose of a workshop or to take pictures somewhere. And the turning point for me, a little bit of personal news, I had a heart attack on June 2nd, 2017. And I was supposed to be on a plane 2 days later to California for work. And I thought, well, my guardian angel was working overtime here, right? And everything worked out just fine. And but the takeaway, as is the case for many people who have little scares like that, is tomorrow isn't promised. You don't know if you're ever going to get, how much time you have and what opportunities you have. So when Abe, my partner, said, "What do you want for your birthday this year?" I said, "I want to do a photo workshop." And the one that was available was Autumn in Wine Country in 2017. So I booked the workshop. It was the beginning of what would be a very transformative series of workshops for me, photographically and personally. I always thought my work was okay, but I really didn't have much to compare it to. I didn't really think I had a style. I found out that I kind of do. I remember you telling us, don't ever apologize for your work, right? It is what it is. Don't apologize for it. It's your best effort. But at the same time, I figured, well, I'm an okay photographer, but I was also really inspired, really humbled by the work of the other photographers in the group. So it inspired me to want to be better. And I had so much fun that I signed up for the San Francisco Street Photography Workshop in 2018, brought my daughter Caitlin with me, met a whole bunch of nice people, and became friends with some of them. We met Timo and Susie and Karen, and Karen and Caitlin and I are still friends, right? We're going out, in fact, in a few weeks to visit Karen and just spend a long weekend with her going out and taking pictures. The next year, the Joshua Tree workshop came up. I called Karen. I said, "You want to do Joshua Tree?" Yeah. I went out early. We drove up together. We did the workshop together. So even outside of the workshops and the friendships and the, acquaintances that you make, I've made real friends, 8, 10-year-old friendships from these workshops. We didn't do workshops in 2020 or 2021, but in 2022, I met another group of great people in Eastern Sierras. That's where I met Chuck and Steve. 2024, I did Sedona with Steve and Marty. Found out that Marty lives an hour away from me. Who knew? We came halfway, all the way across the country to find out that we were an hour apart. So we've gone out shooting back home. I decided to do the Sonoma workshop last year because Steve, Marty, and Harry were going. He hadn't met Harry. And the connections that you make on these workshops and the friendships that I've made are just, they've been just amazing. And now we get together and we're like, well, what do you think Derek's going to do this year? What do you, and we start speculating and like, well, if he does this one, are you in? And we start planning together, right? And we're like, well, let's go out early and we'll hang out and shoot here or there ahead of the workshop, or we'll stay later. And the whole experience has just changed the way I photograph, not only technically, but socially. I used to go out by myself all the time, and I think a lot of photographers are kind of, you go out on your own, and there's a place for that, right? It's really good mental health wise and emotionally, and you don't need anybody else. And if you go out by yourself, you don't annoy anybody when you stop every 30 seconds to take another picture. And so there's a lot to be said for shooting on your own, but there's a lot to be said for shooting with other people too. And now I have a core group that I go out with on the weekends here, and we go out and make pictures together. And I don't think I ever would have done that had it not been for the workshop experience. The other thing is, I learned something every single time. And I learned something creative. I learned something about myself. I learned something technical. I was never into post-processing. You know this. I was like, get it right in camera. Don't be messing it. I didn't want to, because I sit at a computer all day, right? And I didn't like the idea of having to sit in front of a computer and post-process my photos. So I really pushed hard against that for a long time. And then some of the people in the workshops, you and some of the other participants, showed me what I could do with relatively little effort to really make my pictures a whole lot better. And now I'm actually enjoying the post-processing process. Sometimes I just want to shoot a JPEG and be done and live with it, and that's fine. And sometimes I really enjoy just sitting on the couch, got an iPad mini now. Runs Lightroom Mobile, and I just sit back and use my Apple Pencil, and I'm really enjoying the post-processing process. I would never have done that had I not listened to the podcast, never would have done it had I not taken the workshops. So for me, they've been real game changers. And I like my gear. I'm a gearhead, but the best money I spend on this craft, hands down, it is the workshops.
This is an interview that I did with Julianne Kost, Adobe Evangelist, recorded at Photo Plus Expo in 2008. And Julianne was a Photoshop evangelist, teacher for Adobe, and had migrated into Lightroom teaching as well. I persuaded her to talk with us in the O'Reilly Media booth at Photo Plus. And I thought you'd be interested in her perspective about Lightroom, especially looking back to 2008. Here's Julianne.
Start with Lightroom for a second.
Okay.
So tell me about some of the things about Lightroom that, personally resonate with you and that you like.
Okay. So I will say that probably the most important thing for me is just I'm a very tidy person. I'm very organized. And it's very important for me to know where my images are and to like kind of have control of them so that I can find them again. And so I did. I took a sabbatical and I took all of my images off of all of my media, which by media I mean like SyQuest discs. Like I was pretty far behind. I had magneto optical drives, and so I took all that media off and I put it all on hard drives, took it all off CD, took it all off DVDs, organized it all into folders that were like 4.2 gigs so that I could back them up to DVD, put them on three different hard drives, and actually keyworded my entire image library. And
this is where I have to go.
And I know. And sequence them. Now, when I say keyword, okay, so I'm not like, there's people out there that really keyword. If I put like 4 to 5 keywords per image, to me, that's brilliant. If I have the location and if I have the subject matter, I can probably find that image. Because if I knew that I was like in China, in Beijing, in the Forbidden City, I could go right there. And if I knew it was a bench, I can just enter in those keywords and I can find that image. So for me, that's very, very important because I am shooting a lot. And it's just great to be able to find my images.
And
I
actually
only wish.
Oh wait, I don't want to interrupt on the only wish part here.
That Lightroom had been further along when I was originally doing that.
Yes.
So I did all of that in Bridge. So I had all of my keywords. I did everything in Bridge. Now though, what I like about Lightroom is that it kind of reminds me what I should be doing, because it's very easy for me to just say, I'll keyword it later. I'll put my copyright in later.
Right.
You know, and then you don't remember, was that in Munich or Berlin? I have no idea.
Yes.
Yeah, so and I don't want
to
sit there
it's
and look
German
at the date.
It's all German to me, right? All,
yeah. Yes. Right. You have to put an umlaut,
yeah,
and
yes,
it's very confusing.
I know, it's tough. Oh, so, okay, but let's talk about this, because this is one of my favorite features in Lightroom. Part of the reason why I think people don't keyword is because when your pictures are in your computer, you've taken them off your memory card, I know what I want to do is play with the pictures, not keyword.
I know.
You know, and so, I mean, what I really like about this is that the import dialog box, and I want you to talk about for a minute, all the wonderful things you can do with the import dialog box so that when your pictures are in your computer, you can actually play with them.
Yeah. See, that's the best thing for me is that it has trained me. It like takes me down the right path, right? So it does all the stuff and it kind of reminds me to do the stuff and makes the stuff easy that I don't really want to do. Like all the stuff, like I don't want to keyword my images. I don't want to add my copyright, but you know what? It's all stuff I have to do. So as I import the files, it's my big reminder because it's right there in the dialog box. It's like, okay, if you just put in 3 keywords right now, as you put in this card, you probably shot this card all in one location. So put in Berlin, put in, you know, whatever. There are infrared images wherever you are. And it just, you're done. And then you don't have to think about it again. So it kind of takes you down the right path. And I like that, not just when you're importing, but then, you know, once you get into the library module, and then you can do, you know, further refining of keywords. And then I can make my collections, and I can rate my images and make sure I have my good ones, and then I can develop them. So it kind of takes you through this step. And I think it's going to be really useful for pro photographers who haven't really established their workflow. And now they can actually pinpoint it and say, okay, these are the 10 steps that I do. And now that they've got it established and they're doing it consistently, they don't need to do it. They can hand it off to an assistant.
Exactly. Exactly. I think that's great. Now, the pushback I get when I talk to people about this is that if they've done more than one shoot on a card, and so they go, well, I don't want to apply the keywords on import because it's like 3 different places. And so, you know, there's a couple options you have. One option is to do 3 imports because you can check the boxes, right? You can choose what goes in and what goes out. Or do if they're related at all, do broad keywords for that one import and then fine-tune a little bit afterwards.
Absolutely. And because you can select like a big range of images, so like basically, so I just got back from Germany, which is why I keep saying those, you know, this example, but I shot in Munich, I shot on the ICE train, and I shot in Berlin. So, you know, I had images on one card from all of those places. Mm-hmm. So as I imported it in, I just put in, you know, Germany. But then I selected the whole range of Berlin, typed in Berlin, the whole range of the ICE train, typed that in. So within like, you know, 3 selections, I had my keywords for all of those images, even though they were on different cards. And I personally, I actually do one extra step. I use Lightroom to import my images, but I actually take the images off of my card first and put them on my hard drive. I just copy them using the Finder, because then when I import them into Lightroom, I actually copy and convert to DNG at the same time. So I'm using the DNG workflow,
which
is something I could totally do just on import. I don't know why I don't know why I do it in 2 steps, but
I mean we have our quirks, right?
My name is Lawrence Lazar, and I've been a photographer for the past 47 years now. And for your 1,000th show, first of all, that's kind of astonishing. So bravo for that. I think I've been a listener for maybe 14, 15 years now. So not quite an original, but for a very long time. What I wanted to mention was the role of the TDS community and the role it's played in my life personally. Starting off when in the winter of 2021, during the COVID lockdown, I took an infrared photography workshop with you. And for me, it was very meaningful, not only because of the COVID lockdown, but because I had lost my vision from a genetic eye disease. I still have peripheral vision, but I lost my central vision and wondered, am I going to be able to do photography again or anymore? And was really struggling with it. And so I decided I just needed to get out there. And the only way to get out there was to do something virtually. So I took an infrared workshop, and having that community and that support really meant the world to me. And I turned around and took the same workshop a year later. And so just having that support when I was struggling, both because of my disability and struggling because of the lockdown we're going through, really meant the world to me. So I wanted to mention that. But I also wanted to mention the role that the community has played with my practice beyond that, which is I first heard about John Pemberton and his new F2.8 press from the podcast when you put out a call for art maybe 3 years ago, 3.5 years ago. I thought, oh, that's interesting. Maybe I could do that. And then I kind of filed it away. And then you mentioned it again. I'm like, okay, well, he's part of our community. Maybe I'll do it. And I generally do not submit work for calls for art because it was part of our community, I figured I'd give it a try. And then a year ago, John published a monograph of my work, which was hugely important for me. And I not only wouldn't have heard about the call for art, but I certainly wouldn't have applied for it had it not been part of our community, because it felt kind of safe. And I know these guys. Also, a couple of years ago, when you started the Live View publication on Medium, I joined the team. And I've always been a writer, but just never published my work. Both my parents were journalists, and I've been a writer my whole life, but never published anything. And then with Live View, now I maybe once a month, once every 6 weeks, I'll publish something. And so my writing practice is center in my life and in my photography life. And so that's something that I gained from the community. So for me, our community here has provided me with the support of a bunch of photographers who I've gotten to know and to trust, and I love talking with. I've gotten myself published because of our community, and now I've got a regular writing gig on Medium. So I just wanted to thank you and our whole community of folks listening in, because the community really means the world to me. So I just wanted to say thank you and congratulations on 1,000 shows.
This next interview, you may not recognize the name. It's David Lentz. David is very important to me, because he has been with me from the very beginning. David is my sysadmin, has been my sysadmin. We've had one sysadmin for the Digital Story, and it's David until this day. And I thought it would only be appropriate that if I introduced you to the man behind the scenes for 2 decades with this show. So here is David Lentz.
Did you ever dream when I brought this idea to you that this thing would go on this long and you'd be on the hook for this many years?
I had no idea, but 20 years, it's a long time.
It is. So this is one of those interesting history stories about our genesis. So when I was working for O'Reilly Media, we sat in a big area there, and I think at the time I was working for O'Reilly Network, David Lentz was there, and he was then at that time a sysadmin, and we had another developer in there, Mark Levitt, and we had another developer in there named Tony Stubblebine, who is now the CEO of Medium.com. Terry was in there. And she is now also working for Medium.com and is actually the person that brought me into Medium. So here we are, you know, Terry, Mark, David, Tony, myself, all sitting at cubicles in this area working for O'Reilly Media. And it's just crazy 20 years later what we're all doing, and we're still all in touch in various ways. I think, David, the first place we should start is, what did you do for O'Reilly back in those days?
Well, it was the O'Reilly Network, which I think is gone now. And I was hired as the Linux sysadmin. I'm not sure if that's still, if sysadmin is still a thing anymore. I think that term has kind of gone out of popularity. But yeah, I was brought in as a sysadmin, and I spent 2 years as an admin. And then I transitioned to a software engineer, developer on the O'Reilly Network platform that we use to publish the articles and content on the O'Reilly Network.
Yeah, and then Mark was more of a web developer, wasn't he, or more focused on web publishing?
Yeah, yeah, he was a web developer, and Terry Schweitzer was a, yeah. She was kind of, what did she do?
She was a web developer also. She was actually my web developer for the stuff I did for O'Reilly Network and Mac Dev Center. Do you recall what Tony was doing in those days?
Yeah, Tony was a software developer, and she actually was the lead software engineer when I transitioned to a software engineer. So he was kind of my, not officially my boss, I guess, but he was the head software engineer.
Interesting. Okay, so we're all sitting in this big area, and we're, you know, kind of doing our various things. And this is about 2004, 2005 time. Apple was making noises that they were going to support podcasting. Now, podcasting was already going on at that time, but with Apple jumping into the game, I thought, okay, this if I'm ever going to launch a podcast, this would be the time to do it. You know, I'm thinking, I want to do this, but I don't know how to do the back end. I mean, I can learn how to do the front end stuff. I can learn how to, you know, record and edit and do all that stuff. But I didn't know how to do the back end stuff. I approached David and Mark both. And do you recall any of those, like when I first came to you with this idea in those days, or is it just so far back?
I don't remember specifics.
Uh-huh.
I remember Mark helping out at first. I guess he kind of helped out with designing the look.
Yes.
Initially. Don't have any specific memory of those conversations.
So we had this Mexican restaurant in Sebastopol, which is where O'Reilly Media was. We had this Mexican restaurant that we all like called Martha's, and they had this really great back patio. And so we started having lunch meetings back there. And so I could float these ideas by, and the original team was, you know, Mark was going to do the web design, the web developing. David was going to be sysadmin. And then, you know, I would do the, you know, the podcasting itself. But, you know, we wanted to build a whole site that like supported Flickr and, you know, supported Twitter feeds and kind of have a full bodied experience of blogging, the whole deal. And so it wasn't just launching a podcast. It was launching a whole site, which is, you know, thedigitalstory.com, still around today. We would have these lunch meetings and figure it out. And David and Mark both actually said, yeah, I'll help. Let's do it, which I was so appreciative. You had to figure out, didn't you have to figure out where we're going to put this and what we were going to use on the back end?
Of course, the offerings were different then, and I don't even remember where we started it. But yeah, we wanted an independent sort of virtual private server, they call it. We wanted our own server, even though it was relatively small.
We wanted to build it ourselves. We wanted to definitely roll our own. We didn't want to use, there was even then some services and so forth that wasn't of interest to me. And to this day, David maintains everything about the site, and we're still not part of anything. You know, we rent server space, and I have David, and that's what we do, right?
Yeah, I think we've moved the server a couple of times over the years. It's pretty much stayed the same aside from the upgrades. And
so then a big moment came where Mark said that, you know, he wanted to move on and he was going to change jobs. He wasn't going to be able to be part of the digital story anymore. And I was kind of nervous about that. And so I was talking to David about it, and I was going, and I don't know if you remember this, but I remember it very clearly because it was so important to me. And I said, David, we got to find someone to, handle this side of it because I'm just really getting going on this. And do you recall what you said?
I don't, but I must have said that we didn't need anyone else. I mean, you could probably do it ourselves.
That's exactly what you said. You go, well, I can do all of that if you want, if you're okay with it. And here, I didn't even really realize that that you could. I mean, I don't see why not. But so you just took over everything on the backside. So you've done, we've done design changes over the years. You handle all the scripting when I have to change ad tiles. So in addition to keeping the site running, and by the way, folks, this is the guy that keeps the site running. He has helped with just about everything else. Other than recording the podcast itself. Did you do web development at all, or did you just know about it because it was part of kind of integrated with what you did at O'Reilly?
Well, if I recall correctly, that was about the time that I left O'Reilly in 2006 and to go off on my own. Turned out to not be a great decision. Was when 2008 came along. Until then, it was good. But anyway, so I had been kind of delving into those areas because I was doing freelance consulting, and I think I had dabbled in it with some other clients. And so I'm like, yeah, I can, we could do that. It was, it wasn't a super complicated thing, and you were not demanding new, the latest bells and whistles all the time. And so I felt like it was something that we could handle.
Yeah, we had little things that I mean, we always ran in. We've had kind of like milestone things. Like, for instance, I think our original podcast player that was embedded on the site, was that Flash originally or JavaScript or something? But we had to change it to HTML5. Do you remember? That was like a big moment.
Yeah.
I would come to David and I go, we can't use this anymore because now, it's out of vogue or whatever. And so then he would come up with a new way that we could do the player. And then when we had to go to HTTPS, right? And that wasn't that long ago. It probably was that long ago. It just doesn't feel like it was that long ago.
Yeah, 5 or 6 years.
Yeah. And so then we had to go to secure server because if not, certain browsers would, flag us as, hey, this is not a secure, and we couldn't have all of that. So we've had to do some pretty, substantial structural changes along the way, in addition to, changing servers and so forth.
Yeah, I think now that I think about it, I think there was a point when Apple Podcasts stopped supporting Flash.
Yeah, so that was it. That was it.
I think we were using Flash. We had to switch over to an HTML5 based player.
Yeah. And so those have been the kind of things. Now, for my part, I have always tried to be really good about, I do the updates. I do the HTML. What I've tried to be is not a pain in the ass, because I figured if I wasn't a pain in the ass, then, he would keep doing this.
Oh, yeah, definitely not a pain in the ass. Actually, over the years, it's become like, well, I'll check in every once in a while, make sure things are up to date.
Yeah.
But it pretty much runs itself.
It does. It does. And, part of that is that you've just done a good job with setting it up so well. So the reason why, David, I wanted to have you on, I wanted everyone to hear the voice of the guy that actually keeps this show on the road. And the voice of the guy that was here before anyone else is here, except for me. I wanted to thank you so much for being a part of this for 20 years.
Well, you're welcome. And thanks for including me in your 1,000th podcast.
1,000, sir. 1,000. I promise you, I won't do 1,000 more. Okay. All right. All right. Thanks, David.
Well, thank you.
So first of all, Derek, let me say congratulations on your 1,000th episode. I think it's just such an amazing and wonderful accomplishment. I'm not sure I'd even been born when show number one was recorded, but it is a great accomplishment. And again, congratulations. As I thought about the memories that I have had of being involved with the Inner Circle over the last few years, there's really one memory that sticks out to me, and I know you'll remember it as well. It happened when we were in the Durango workshop last fall. We had a great group of folks on that trip, all of us staying in a wonderful old converted barn that had been converted into kind of a VRBO kind of place. One of the participants, and her name was Cindy, just before that workshop, Cindy had resolved kind of a, I don't know if it was an insurance issue or something that had taken a protracted amount of time. And to celebrate that personally, she had brought along a very special sort of limited release bottle of bourbon that she wanted to use to celebrate the resolution of that matter. On the last night of the workshop, last night of the trip, Cindy talked to the group and told us all how special the week had been for her and that she wanted to take this opportunity to share this wonderful bottle of bourbon with the entire group. It hadn't been her original plan, but as the week went on and we developed the camaraderie and the warmth and the feeling of togetherness, it just seemed the right thing for her to do. And she made that offer to the group. And, you know, we all protested. And I would point out that we rather weakly protested, truth be told, that she didn't need to do that. But after that weak protest, we enthusiastically helped her enjoy the entire bottle. We completely enjoyed the bottle, as I recall. I didn't realize how special that bottle was until I got home and tried to find another one to purchase, and it just wasn't available anywhere. So although I can't get another bottle like that, it probably wouldn't taste as good anyway without the special group to enjoy it with. To me, that evening and Cindy's generous heart speaks to exactly the kind of community that the Inner Circle has represented to me over the years that I've been involved with it.
A key to our survival here at The Digital Story is evolution. We have to change as the circumstances around us evolve. And one of the ways that we're moving forward is by bringing in fresh voices with different experiences. Rob Knight is now teaching online classes for The Digital Story. He and I are co-leading physical workshops together. And I think he is an important member of this community because even though we see things in a very similar fashion, we still have different viewpoints. And it's nice to have those different voices as we continue to move forward into the next 1,000 podcasts. So I thought it would be fun if Rob sat down with me and we talked a little bit about that. So here we go. Here's Rob Knight.
Hey, Rob, thank you so much for jumping on.
Totally my pleasure, man. Congratulations on, what is it, 6 million episodes? Is that
6 million? Yeah.
6 millionth episode.
It feels like 6 million.
I bet it does, man. I don't know how you do it.
When I started this thing, in the early days, I go, what am I going to come up with every week? It's amazing. 1,000 podcasts later, I guess there's just so much going on in our world, of photography and everything, that the world just sort of takes care of it for me.
I'm always impressed how even when there'll be weeks when I think I have no idea what Derek's going to talk about this week, but man, you always pull something interesting out. And wow, 1,000 episodes, man. Seriously, though, congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. You and I are working together now, and I'm loving it because I just feel like our skills complement each other so well. But I think the thing I wanted to talk about was how we got started with this, because I think that story's kind of cool, actually. I mean, we knew each other. We knew of each other. We'd say hi in the hallways out of Chicago or whatever. But when we first decided, hey, you know, let's actually put a stake in the ground and try to make something happen, that was in Costa Rica before the pandemic. And I thought maybe you might want to share your side of the story. I always tell the story And you're probably thinking the whole time I tell it, like, oh, he doesn't know what he's talking about.
Not at all. Not at all. It's a pretty simple story, but like you said, it's not all of us that do this can do it together, right? Not every teacher is compatible just in the way that we do things and the way that we treat our clients and ethos, I guess. And not that one is better or worse than the other, but you know, some people just work well together. And I think we've proved that to ourselves and our clients that we definitely work well together. But yeah, we were in Costa Rica on a trip for Olympus that I had actually set up just because they wanted to release the EM1 Mark III, I believe. And they wanted to go somewhere fun with the press. And so they wanted to go to Costa Rica. And I, you know, having done that for years and years, they called me, thank goodness. And so I set this thing up, and gosh, I don't remember how many journalists and bloggers and podcasters and everybody were there. But you and I, like you said, we've known each other. I don't even know. I don't remember, you know, me. Oh, this is Derek Story. Hi, I'm Rob. I don't remember that moment, but we've just known each other and known about each other. And gosh, I probably heard you for the first time on TWIP years ago or something like that. But yeah, we just kind of seem to always end up in conversation on that trip in Costa Rica. And then there we are on overlooking Playa Hermosa as the sun is setting into the Pacific. And, you know, we finished dinner and we're working on our rum drinks. And we just got to talking about how we teach and why we teach and the things that we try to get across and the things that we don't like. And I think there was this moment where I was like, you know, I know it's fun to work in Costa Rica. I've got that workshop format down kind of. And I thought, man, you and I would have a lot of fun teaching together in Costa Rica. We should do something. And I remember you kind of looked at me funny, like, yeah, like, wait, come here again? Yes, let's do that.
I thought it was, what was interesting to me when we were talking is that you're right. We got very philosophical. I think rum does that sometimes. We got very philosophical, and it was really interesting because the things that you did during the workshops, like, you are so good in the field, you know, you are patient, and you'll sit there and you'll grab someone's camera controls and help them figure out why it isn't doing what they want it to do, and you know, all those things. And I had already seen you at play, you know, obviously, during the Costa Rica thing, and I was going, man, you know, combine that with then I really like doing the labs and the class presentations and, you know, assignments and all that kind of stuff. And I go, boy, it's peanut butter and chocolate here. And I thought, boy, if I could work with this guy in the field, I would love it. And as it turned out, we got something put together, and then Costa Rica wouldn't let us do it.
It's wild to think about all the changes that came from the pandemic. You know, I had not been with Olympus for very long, and then I see my whole year worth of classes and exhibitions and presentations and keynote addresses at big events all just canceled in a matter of a week. It's interesting too, because I started working with Mighty Networks as a platform and eventually set up an Olympus nature photography class online. And I remember telling you about that, and you're like, oh, that's cool. And now that's the inner circle.
Well, I mean, one of the things that we did, and I think this really worked well for both of us in the end, was during the pandemic, we talked, what, a couple times a month?
Mm-hmm.
Just called, like, how are you doing? What's going on? You know, because all of us who did what we did for a living, you know, were just kind of shell-shocked from suddenly all my jobs were gone. All my physical jobs were gone, right? Right. And we're trying to reinvent ourselves during this terrible time. And so you'd be going, well, what are you doing? What are you up to? And I'd go, what are you up to? What are you doing? And during those conversations, I think I floated an idea by you that I wanted to start doing more online work, and I wanted to move a more cohesive community online, you know, that was more interactive. But sure. I didn't want to do it on Facebook, and I didn't want to do it on anyone else's platform, because my whole experience is that if I do it on someone else's platform or then it just gets taken away from me at some point, or they screw it up. And I wanted to be in charge of it. And that's when you told me about Mighty Networks. So I went and checked it out, and I think a week later, Rob, I started putting that whole thing together.
Yeah, it was the everything looks great according to their marketing, right? Like, of course, the platform said, well, this sounds like exactly what I'm looking for, but it never really is. But the more that I think the two of us dug into Mighty Networks, we're like, oh wow, you can do that. Oh, that's cool. I wish it could do this. Oh, it can do that. Well, that's really interesting. And yeah, I ran it's funny because I ran an online course for, I think, 6 weeks that was great. Everybody really participated, and it was a great group, and everybody was curious, and then they posted their images during the class, and it was wonderful. And then I had another group, I think just right away, just the next group, and nobody really was interested, and nobody participated, and it had the exact opposite energy of that first group. And it kind of turned me off of the whole thing. I was like, well, this is because it's a lot of work to do that, as you know. But it was really cool. Here we are 3, 4 years later, and you started doing it and kept doing it and worked through the bad classes and all that stuff. And it's really cool to see where the inner circle is and all that stuff now. It's wild. It's like, wow, if I had done that for the last 4 years too, but I didn't have to because you did it. So that's great. I'm really
Yeah,
happy to see that.
and I think the thing that saved me on this was the podcast itself, right? This very thing that we're celebrating right now, because that's what developed the community, and that's what kept the community together, good times, bad times. We're doing the podcast, and practically everyone that comes to class now, rather because you're teaching with us as well, practically everyone that comes to class, it comes through that door of the podcast, and that is what's brought us all together here. And now you and I are doing physical workshops. We're talking about some great stuff for next year. I get to have you teach on our online workshop schedule, which is just fantastic, and people just love the work you do. And I think this podcast is just really is the glue that has held this whole thing together.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think the reason that it works that way is because all you have to do is listen to the Digital Story podcast, and you know what you're going to get with Derek Story. You're smart, and you're measured, and you're just even keeled, and that's how you are when you teach too. Any chance that you get to introduce yourself to your potential clients is a huge benefit, especially when it's a weekly opportunity for people to get to know you, and then they're like, this guy really knows what he's talking about. I'm gonna take a class.
It really does help. That known quantity thing is for real. And we just got a recent example of that. When you're doing your online class on creativity, signups were going well. They were going well. I was really happy with them. And then, we said, well, okay, let's do a conversation about that workshop a couple weeks before it. Where you just get to talk about what you want to do in that workshop. And in the course of 1 week, registrations doubled
Yeah.
after we had that conversation.
What a coincidence, huh?
What a coincidence. They really got to know you on that podcast and then go, oh man, yeah, I would like to hear more about that. Now that we've said this, right? Now we do have to keep doing stuff together. You realize
Oh, yeah, I hope so. That's why I'm here.
that. All
I'm
right.
locking you in.
Okay, same here. All right, buddy. Hey, thanks so much for coming by. I truly appreciate it.
Oh, you bet, man. Congratulations. Thanks again.
My name is Sergio Borani, and I live in Morristown, New Jersey. I am the owner of Photos by Sergio Photography for Philanthropy, a small photo practice designed to help local charities achieve their objectives. It is a privilege for me to participate in the celebration of the 1000th edition of the TDS Photography Podcasts. When you began, Derek, I was not aware of your podcast. After I started listening, I sort of became addicted. It became a regular Tuesday morning commitment. I am sure I listened to more than half of your podcasts, since I clearly remember celebrating your 500th anniversary. Well, of course, I'm here to remember a TDS moment with you and with your audience. There are many that I can recall, but there is one that truly stands out. It was back in October 2017, when your community in Santa Rosa was engulfed in a tragic fire that came close to reaching your own house. The way you shared your situation with your audience had a profound impact on me. Your tone was dramatic, yet very controlled. You managed to talk about photography, as you always do, but also describe the seriousness of your situation. It was in that moment that I realized that you, Derek Story, were not only a photographer, but also a very sensitive human being, a virtue that you have manifested over and over again in the following years. Thank you, Derek, for your valuable photography advice, but also for the humanity that you inject into your communication. Congratulations, Derek, for achieving this great milestone. Most importantly, keep doing what you're doing. Our community is very grateful to you.
I've listened not since the beginning, might have missed the first 100, 150, but I've been in for most of those. I had a really long, difficult commute, and on Tuesdays I would usually have Derek's podcast listened to probably by 7 o'clock in the morning. I was always amazed at how reliably they were posted. So there's a lot of very memorable ones. I was really impressed with the interview that you posted with your mom when she passed. It had a good message because, you know, pictures and videos are most important with people. She gave a really good interview, and it was kind of nice to hear you chatting with each other, and just like what matters most in life when it comes right down to it. You know, all these pretty pictures that we take. Some of your artwork could go on for years, but I mean, I think the people pictures are really important. And there was a lot of that talk in that interview. Then I would say lastly, right around the last time was Dibs the Studio Cat. You just gave like a really good story about, you know, how you found her and until the last day that you had her. I just think it was really good storytelling. I was taking one of your online classes very recently, and I think I'd seen Dibs the Cat for the first time, because I think you might have used her as a subject for maybe depth of field or some kind of example. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's a pretty cat. And it wasn't too long after that, I guess that episode came up and you talked in depth about how you found her and how, because I guess we heard a few things about your cat over the years in your podcasts. And that was a very impactful episode also. And listening to this, driving along on the highway, and these my trip to work early in the morning, and I was just like, wow, it's a tough thing. And it just was amazing that you're able to put the podcast out with such reliability and for so many years, and I really thank you for that. I know a lot of the people out there also enjoy that and really appreciate it. That's what I had to say. Thank you.
This is me without a script, without writing any notes beforehand, because I didn't want to for this final segment of the show. What I want to say is that I am blown away by the support that I have received from this community for 2 decades. We have seen so many things together. It's crazy. It really is. How many other podcasts, how many other communities do you know of that are this vibrant after this period of time? It's really a testament to all the members, all the people who show up for our online workshops, our physical workshops, who become Inner Circle members, who join us on Facebook, just any place where we can touch each other with the shared interest of photography and technology and just enjoying the great outdoors. So this is where I want to say thank you to everyone that's listening to the show. I cannot express how much I appreciate you being here and allowing us all to move forward together. Now, a lot of folks have asked me, well, after you do your 1,000th show, are you going to retire? The answer is no. I'm not going anywhere. So next week, we will have show number 1,001. Isn't that crazy? And I've got a hot topic to discuss, and I'm already looking forward to it. So here we go. We're off on the next 1,000 episodes. Thank you for being here, and see you next week.